You are listening to Faith is Brewing, a Magic the Gathering podcast for the rogue deck builder. Each week we design new decks in Modern and Pioneer. We put our creations to the test and share our findings on the air. Coming up on the brew session, 5 new decks with In Search of Greatness, a mysterious mana engine that pushes deck building to the limit. Then on a flashback, testing results with Righteous Valkyrie. That's all coming up on episode 13 of Kaldheim Season. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson, joined after a week off by Damon Alexander. Damon, what's going on?
Not too much. It's good to be back and in search of new cards to break.
Absolutely. And we are joined in this quest, as always, by the CEO of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. He is Dan Schriever. Dan, what's up?
Yeah, I'm doing well. Last week's card almost broke me, so I'm hoping we have a better time of it with the card that we've selected for this episode.
So just a quick reminder, we are releasing 2 episodes a week. You've probably heard our earlier episode on Friday talking about the new metagame and the post-ban world of both Pioneer and Modern. This week, we are going to look back at some of our brews from Righteous Valkyrie. But first, we are going to start looking at designing some decks around our card of the week, which is In Search of Greatness. Damon, why don't you read the card to us so we can start to think about it?
Yeah, so it says green, green for an enchantment. At the beginning of your upkeep, you may cast a permanent spell from your hand with CMC equal to 1 plus the highest, mana value among other permanents you control without paying its mana cost. If you don't, scry 1.
Yeah, so there's some interesting rules notes here. It's got a strange trigger. So the trigger goes on the stack at the start of your upkeep, and then when it resolves, you may cast something. You don't have to, even if you have something that meets the criteria. And then if you decline to do so, you scry 1. You cast a quote-unquote permanent spell from your hand. So that is creature, planeswalker, artifact, enchantment. Casting without paying its mana cost, so it still goes on the stack. It can still be countered. You can still pay additional costs, so that's kicker.
Yeah, I guess kicker is the main one. But you can't adventure, though, because that wouldn't meet the criteria.
Correct, yeah, because the adventure spells are all instants or sorceries. So you have to cast Bonecrusher Giant. That's a permanent. Stomp is not a permanent. And then you can cast either half of the MDFCs as long as they both meet the condition. So obviously some of them have like the green legend that's 3 mana. The front and backside is 3 CMC or mana value. So if you have this in play and another 2 mana card in play, then you can play either half. But if you have like Alrend, if only Alrend meets the condition, then you can't cast your sweet little crow. And it's worth to note, I think this is what fooled a lot of people, including me when I first read it. It's other permanents you control, so it doesn't see itself. It doesn't automatically trigger and put and generate 3 mana on your next upkeep. You can trigger it for 1 if you only have lands, so that's always worth noting. Ones can be free. And the number is calculated in response to the resolution. So the trigger goes on the stack. You do have time to flash in cards in response, so you can change what it's trying to find. And then if they're killed in response, then it goes back to the next value. So if you just have lands and you cast a flash card, you can put in the flash card CMC plus 1. If they kill the flash card before that trigger resolves, then you can go back to putting in a 1 drop if all you have is lands. So yeah, it's kind of a strange card. Damon, what attracted you to this card? This is a card that you were kind of inkling for when we were discussing earlier this week.
Yeah, this card picked up a lot of hype coming into spoiler season. And you know, let's be honest, we're in the kind of back half of our Kaldheim episodes, so the card quality can dwindle a bit. I have some doubts about this card, but also there's like an interesting kind of bull case for it. And it sits in this 2 CMC spot, like a card like Search for Iskanta or Sylvan Library or Maze Mind Tome, where it comes in perhaps before your opponent has counter magic up, comes down on a turn where it's okay to take turn 2 off. A lot of the time you can do that and not feel like you're falling too far behind. And then meanwhile, it provides incremental value throughout the game. Every single turn you get to scry 1. Or sometimes you get to just make big plays and double spell. double spell, not only like by playing two chief spells, but by playing two spells kind of maybe the near the top of your curve. You know, if you play this into a three drop on turn four, you can get eight mana potentially. And that's entering Fires of Invention territory, but on a two drop, again, with a good failure mode of scrying one every turn.
Interesting to me that the cards you named, Search for Escanto, Sylvan Library, Maze Mind Tome, these are cards that manipulate the top of your deck. And you didn't really talk, apart from Fires of Invention, about the mana generation aspect. Whereas when I look at this card, I'm like, oh, well, that's probably the big draw is to get that Aether Vial-like effect, right? I wouldn't play it if it was just going to scry.
Yeah, yeah. But I think that you don't have to actually get a, like, you look at this and you're like, well, how do I make sure I, like, reliably get the mana, like, the free cast every single turn for the next five turns? I think it's okay if you don't. I think that if you play this and get, you know, four mana worth of it, or maybe a, you know, a free five drop or something, just any time in the next three turns or so of the game, it's okay from the other turns you're just scrying one.
Yeah, that's kind of how I think about it, too. You're putting two mana into it. If you ever get three or four mana out of it and you only do it once, then you've just gained net mana out of it. And then everything else is literally just free scries.
That's true, but like, think of the opportunity cost. You drew that card instead of just an actual mana source. Compare this to just having an elf or a ramp card or just another land that will generate a mana for you every single turn at an easier spot on the curve. The other issue I have is that a lot of the decks you might build with this probably would just much rather have an Aether Vial, and maybe that's a modern-only problem. But when you compare these two cards head-to-head, Aether Vial is just so much better. Damon's just shaking his head a little bit.
Well, okay, so one thing is that you don't have to play this as like a 4-of build around. You could play this as like a 1-of value. And actually, in an Aether Vial deck, playing turn one Aether Vial, turn two a Source of Greatness is actually pretty good because you get a free 2-drop next turn on a hard-to-kill 1-drop.
Although these both fall victim to the black-green Strix card that's
it's true,
spoiled,
it's so true. But it's not
we
released
yet. We have to get
yet.
This in before Strixhaven is released.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a Vial and a Search for Greatness, you never need another land. You can just play all MDFCs and just put them all in that way.
I think the only time Aether Vial is actually better than this is if you play it on turn one, and then it's way better than this. I agree.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, it's that Aether Vial is easy to build around. Aether Vial, you put it on the desired number, and it just stays there, and then you activate it over and over again at like three counters or something. This one, the number changes so often, and it kind of asks your deck to have a bunch of different mana values in your hand, not just in your deck, but in your hand. I mean, that's kind of crazy. You know, there's some aspect of this that reminds you a little bit of like, okay, going up a chain, like a Birthing Pod or Pyre of Heroes, Neoform, that kind of thing. But like, those are searching your deck, right? There you need to have the toolbox somewhere in your 60. This is just like, does your hand happen to have something of the exact same mana value? And if so, cool. But then what about next turn? Well, next turn, that number has changed. So you can't even really reliably build around it. And that's what's kind of scaring me about this card.
Yeah. What's sad is that at some point your deck plays its highest mana value card, and then this card can't do anything because it can only go one higher than your current highest mana value. And so that is kind of a downside. Originally, I thought this card was like, well, up to that number. And so that means that, yeah, like you're not going to get this to trigger that many times in a game. But still, I don't think you need it to trigger that many times for it to be worth it.
Well, I hope you're right. We're going to give it our best shot. David's got some lists queued up. I want to just say a few words about like how I would approach building around this if forced to for In Search of Greatness Week, for example, on Faith is Brewing. There's a great article by Brian Gottlieb of the Arena Decklist podcast. He wrote this article on Star City, mainly with a focus on Standard, but he laid out basic five rules for what you need to do to make this card work for you. The rules are as follow. One, you need a high permanent count. So this is not going to help you with spells. So anytime you are including something that is instant or sorcery in your deck, you're just making your In Search of Greatnesses that much worse. Number two, stay flush on cards. The more cards you have in your hand, the more cards you're drawing throughout the game, the more likely you are to be able to get something out of this. Number three, work the entirety of the curve. So this is that Birthing Pod style of build we talked about. That does mean that you might not be able to just like focus on a particular play pattern. You might need to actually just sort of have some variety. Variety is the spice of life, and just hope that on some turns of the game, you'll get that mana burst. But yeah, I mean, if you've topped out on a certain number of mana value, then this will just sort of stop working for you. Number four, this one's a little bit counterintuitive. Have a home for excess mana in the sense that if you're getting free mana off In Search of Greatness and then you have nothing to do with your actual lands, it's like you didn't actually use the free mana. So take a page from the Ethervial decks and have mana sinks, whether that's lands with activated abilities or just other places to put your free mana on the turns when you do get the excess mana. And finally, you got to make sure that you're getting double green early in the game. So those are all big picture bird's eye view level. How would you approach a card like this? But in terms of like specific tricksy things you can do, David, are there any interactions that jump out to you as particularly promising?
Well, I think the interaction with the green ley line is of interest. The ley line comes into play for free, so it gives you a high CMC permanent. The green ley line also happens to work with mana elves. So if you don't draw this card, a mana elf plus the ley line gets you to 5 mana as well very fast. So you kind of have multiple avenues to pursue that. I also really like the interaction of Omen of the Sea with this trigger on the stack. It allows you to play a 3-drop. It's not a tutor, obviously, but you get to look at 3 cards. So between your opening hand and Omen, you've got a reasonable shot at finding a 3 CMC card to play for free. And there's a few of them, including Tracker, that actually pay you off for still having your land drop left after you play this in your upkeep. And Tracker kind of draws more cards into finding more cards that, you know, could cost 4 mana in that case. So I think that there's a few tutor effects that are reasonably playable in Modern. There aren't very many in Pioneer. Stoneforge Mystic can tutor for just naturally a 3 CMC artifact. If she survives, you can play it for free. And the green-white tutor for a creature is also an instant speed card, so you can do it in response. You can wait and see what your trigger is going to be. Of course, your opponent can respond to that if they see that you've tutored a 3 CMC creature because your trigger's on the stack. They can bolt your Quaddle or whatever.
Yeah, I like those three broad categories of tips and tricks, I guess. So the first two you mentioned are kind of ways of jumping the curve, right? Making it go a little bit faster, whether that's cheating a permanent into play quickly, like a ley line. You could also consider like a delve creature for this kind of effect to just go higher up the curve. But a totally different way to do it is the Omen line. Just anything that is a permanent with flash allows you to, you know, get that turns In Search of Greatness at a higher number than you were scheduled to, essentially. And the tutors, I think, are also very important, just sculpting your hand to have the right thing at the right time. Karn the Great Creator is another one that I think is worth exploring in that connection.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And the thing with Stoneforge Mystic is anybody who's ever played Stoneforge Mystic on turn 2 to fetch a Sword of Fire and Ice knows what I'm talking about. You look at your turn 3 and you're like, what do I do now? You have a Sword of Fire and Ice, you know, end of turn, Stoneforge Mystic it in. And then it's like it takes kind of almost 2 turn cycles to activate your sword. In Search of Greatness, like, really speeds that up.
So let's take a look at some lists. David, you have some in Pioneer, some in Modern. Where do you want to start?
Let's start in Pioneer. So Pioneer has banned the green ley line, so we can't do any brewing around that. I tooled around with some of the other ley lines. I think the blue one is maybe the most playable in the abstract, but it just was too many moving parts. So the first list I want to start with is a blue-green Enchantress Search for Greatness list. So we have 4 Search for Greatness. We have 4 Omen of the Sea. Like I said before, I think those are relatively crucial cards. I really like Oath of Nyssa as a cheap 1-mana play. It lets you play fewer lands. Oath is also just a card that's not going to ever die. So it gives you a free 1-mana permanent in play for Search for Greatness. The other thing I want to highlight with Search for Greatness is that Scry ability has a lot of use. There's a lot of discussion sometimes, what's a Scry 1 worth? It's not worth half a card. That's wrong. But it is useful if your deck has a bunch of certain cards it wants to find. So Enchantress decks want to find 4 Setessan Champion or 4 Eidolon of Blossom. So those are the key cards. And so when you have cards that are much more important than other cards, that Scry value is useful. That Oath of Nyssa is useful. Your 3-drops, you have Setessan Champion as a great 3-drop to play. So the nut draw, if you want to call it that, would be like an Oath of Nyssa, find your Setessan Champion. Turn 2, Search for Greatness. Turn 3 with the trigger on the stack, flash in Omen of the Sea, play Setessan Champion, and then you have 1 mana left to play Mana Bloom, Bind the Monster, or Oath of Nyssa. So you get your trigger right away on Setessan Champion that turn 3. And Setessan Champion and Eidolon of Blossoms are both cards that draw a bunch of cards. So when your hand is full of cards, you're more likely to have, again, we don't have tutor effects, we have to do it the raw power way, you're more likely to have cards at the right CMC. You know, maybe they kill your champion, but you've drawn another 3-drop because you've been oathing or whatever. So this is kind of like a shell. I think if you could maybe make the mana work, you could play like a Bant version. I have a 5-drop here to trigger off Eidolon, which is Elder Gargara. I do think that's a fine card, but maybe the better play is Sigil of the Empty Throne. The mana just gets tough though in Pioneer. You know, we don't have the Fetch Shock mana base. So if you can tool around and make it work, maybe you don't need white early. You just have enough white to play Sigil late. I'm not sure how all that would work, but you don't want to make your mana too bad because you do need green-green on turn two a reasonable percentage of the time. And you still want access to blue because I do think the Search for Greatness, Omen of the Sea interaction is very powerful.
Yeah, what I like a lot about this list is Island of Blossoms is one of those cards where the turn after you play it is always great, but the turn you play it is always super just clunky. And so when Search for Greatness just totally dodges that, you play it and you still have all your mana up with this kind of curve you described, and that with that mana, you just go nuts immediately, playing your cheap enchantments, drawing cards, the sky's the limit. And likewise, Sigil of the Empty Throne, it always sucks to take a turn off to cast that card. If you can sneak that into play for free off of In Search of Greatness, that's actually quite strong. And you don't even need to have planes or white sources in play to do so.
Yeah, and the one thing that this deck is trying to take advantage of is Dan's talking about, you know, sometimes there's a fail case. Search for Greatness is just scrying every turn. Well, a deck with four Sedestan Champion and four Eidolon of Blossoms doesn't just hate playing a two-mana enchantment that scries. It's not the worst. It's not the super strong play, but at least it's going to trigger Sedestan Champion. It's going to trigger Eidolon of Blossoms. It's going to trigger Sigil of the Empty Throne. So if those cards are in play, the fact that maybe you don't have exactly the right thing to get to mana burst, like Dan's saying, where you really, you know, he likes getting all you can out of a card, at least the failsafe is it's immediately replacing itself, maybe if you have one of those enchantress effects in play, or it's making an angel. So
this reminds me so much of the enchantress builds that I was trying in green white, and their mana bloom was the best card because of the way it works with constellation. But in order to really make that hum, you needed a cost reducer, Herald of the Pantheon. Herald of the Pantheon kind of sucks. It dies to everything, and it's like the only creature like that. I don't really want to play it. So if you're getting even just like dropping a free mana bloom into play could be enough. But then again, this has the problem of, you know, once you get the Eidolon down, your Search for Greatness is just going to sit there. So I'm not totally sure about this. I'm intrigued by the Bant option, and I almost want to play that Nico Aris Planeswalker that I think is really good, but no one else is playing. You have eight Constellation creatures here. You have Oath of Nissa to make the mana work, and it's a mana sink, cracking all those shard tokens for turns when you happen to have all your mana free.
Yeah, that's actually, I'm not joking. I didn't think of that card as a three drop because it didn't show up on like all my searches. I did consider Narset, but Nico, because Oath of Nissa, the problem is this deck can never really hard cast it, but between Oath of Nissa, maybe Mana Bloom, and maybe Search of Greatness just playing it for free, that's actually not bad. I actually don't hate that. And to Dan's point, you can pay kicker. So if you're casting in the late game and you have mana up, you can pay for all these sweet clues. Or whatever they're, what are they called? Shards?
Yeah, they're enchantment clues, but they scry one when you crack them.
Yeah, so like cut the baffling in, that's garbage, and play one of those, try that out. I like that.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to at least tinker with this. Omen of the Sea is a card that I never actually put into my Enchantress decks, and it's by far the best card in these lists.
Yeah, I love the interaction between Search for Greatness and Omen of the Sea. I was kind of casting about for something, and that's something I'm very interested in doing. Like, that at least is a play that's at like the sort of elite level that these other mid-range decks are doing. I don't know about the rest of the deck.
Now, these lists, although they are blue and green and based on enchantments, are not playing Enigmatic Incarnation.
No.
But you have another sketch here that looks in that direction.
Yeah, so this is four color. It's not playing red. So again, we're trying to show a little bit of respect for the casting cost of Woeful Haven green-green. We're going into black because we need black for removal. Mana Bloom is going to have to do a lot of work as well. And yeah, so again, we have our sort of four Woeful Haven, four Search for Greatness, four Omen of the Sea. And then we have a bunch of like kind of tutorable two drops and tutorable three drops that all work with Enigmatic Incarnation. And then I think even Damon was saying in our chat, In Search for Greatness is a two mana enchantment. So if we want, we can sacrifice it at any time, turn into a Skyclave Apparition or, you know, lure us to the Dream Den or something with Enigmatic Incarnation. And then the list just kind of has interesting targets at the various CMCs all the way up to even a couple fives, which are Urien to blink a bunch of the effects in this deck, Tulsimir, and one Scarab God.
This list is sweet. I definitely like this list a lot. Maybe Enigmatic Incarnation will do well for us. We know it's been doing well for other people recently.
Yeah, so one thing to note is a lot of those 5-0 lists, and there's been a bunch of different builds that have done it, but the recent 5-0 lists are basically playing Fires of Invention. So they're incentivized to play other cards. Cards that fetch lands, for instance, are much better if you're going to play Fires. You always want to have four lands. You're not interested in the ramp from Wolf of Lohaven or Mana Bloom. We're kind of replacing Fires with In Search for Greatness. I don't think you want too many of those cards that don't actually do anything and they're supposed to be kind of your mana engine. So this deck is sort of taking a more explosive mana and or In Search of Greatness. That's kind of our plan on our first two turns.
Yeah, and the Pioneer Enigmatic Incarnation build is really weird. It's got somewhat like the weirdest Triome and Checkland combinations. It's got Path of the World Tree, which they can actually activate when they have Fires freeing up all their mana. So it's a great Yorian deck. I mean, Yorian Fires is proven. In that sense, it's asking a lot of In Search for Greatness to actually compete straight up with Fires, but you are able to drop red as a color, and I think maybe your curve is a little more concentrated at the 2-3 spot, which is what the modern versions of Enigmatic Incarnation successfully do, whereas the Pioneer ones like go as high as 5 mana creatures, and that's like a little weird.
Yeah, this deck also has like the actual best draws, which again are going to be rare because you're playing a Urien deck, are going to be much faster. You can play an Enigmatic Incarnation on turn 3, and there's like 9 cards that accelerate you to that. I think the other list was playing 0 accelerants, so it'll never, ever play Enigmatic Incarnation on 3. But there are trade-offs, like Dan says. We know that the Fires engine is very powerful. Fires itself interacts reasonably well with Enigmatic Incarnation. You can Fires and Incarnation on the same turn, and then at the end of turn, Enigmatic Incarnation turns that Fires into Scarab God, Tulsimir. They are playing one Dvmizzet because they're playing 5 colors. So this deck is going to play out differently, but it's gonna try to take advantage, hopefully, of In Search for Greatness.
Before we leave this Enchantress angle, I was curious if you think Sagas are worth exploring with In Search for Greatness. And the thing that interests me about them is that they go away after a couple turns, which means you could, in theory, build around a curve that like topped out on 4 or something, if it's all like a bunch of 4 mana Sagas like Showdown of the Skalds or Binding of the Old Gods. And then they eventually put themselves in the graveyard so that you can put another one in with In Search for Greatness.
Yeah, the problem is most Sagas don't actually draw. So how am I making sure that I keep drawing my 4s?
Yeah, that's true.
Like the thing is, the Saga kind of just pays you off already. You know, for instance, Binding of the Old Gods, as we talked about, is a card that's very powerful. It's seeing a lot of play in Pioneer. It's already giving you an extra land. So once that's in play, I don't need to worry about getting a mana burst. It's like taking me up to 5 or 6 mana.
Well, one example is Elspeth Conqueror's Death in, for example, your Enchantress versions where, you know, you have Eidolon Blossoms out. This lets you get a free Elspeth Conqueror's Death from In Search of Greatness. And then at some point, Elspeth Conqueror's Death goes out of the way, gets back a Desitessen champion, and clears the way for In Search of Greatness that you play your next Elspeth Conqueror's Death.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly a way to build it. My concern is I don't think we have the kind of time to do that. Once your engine's online, if you're getting 2 bursts of Wolf or from In Search of Greatness and you're not winning, I don't think you're going to win the game. So like having a way to constantly get 4 and 5 mana out of it, I think is asking too much of the card.
Yeah, I guess you need to have some sort of like counter magic so that you can kind of like Elspeth Conqueror's Death to keep the board clear, but also be able to counter their, you know, Emergent Ultimatum or whatever.
Right.
So those are 3 options for building a Pioneer list focused on enchantments. A lot of the tools that we mentioned, though, are only available in Modern. So things like Stoneforge Mystic or other flash creatures like Icefang Quetzal, etc., Aelid Amri's Call. So David, do you want to maybe shift us over to Modern and tell us about some of your ideas there?
Yeah, so Modern has the ability to play Leyline of Abundance. When this card was broken in Pioneer, before it was banned, we started experimenting with some shells that were using this in Modern. So what I've built here is a list that takes some of the lessons that we learned there, which is, you know, we've got a bunch of mana elves. We've got Oath of Nyssa. We do have the Leyline of Abundance, which, as we know, works very powerfully with Search for Greatness. And then this also has Karn the Great Creator, which, as Dan mentioned, has the ability to tutor. So if you have Search for Greatness in play and you resolve a Karn the Great Creator, you can -2 at that turn to put a 5 in your hand. Or if you knew that for sure it's going to die, maybe you could search for a 2 mana card if they were going to bolt it or whatever. But you can basically pick a card, an artifact from your graveyard, from your sideboard, that allows you to trigger Search for Greatness if Karn lives, or if you again believe Karn's going to die and you only have an Oath of Nyssa in play, you could, you know, pick to get your 2 mana artifact that you feel is relevant. We also just have 5s naturally in our deck: Elder Gargaroth and Nyssa. Elder Gargaroth obviously very good against the Prowess shells. Nyssa just an insanely powerful card, and if you get to play it for free, it allows all your forests, they didn't have to tap to play Nyssa, so they're all doubling that turn. It's a huge mana boost. You basically get the ability to, like, let's say you play Search for Greatness on two and you had a Leyline of Abundance in play. On your next turn, you play Nissa. Each of your lands taps for two, and then the one that you untap with Nissa taps for three. So you basically have the ability to put 14 mana or use 14 mana effectively that turn. That's an insane possibility.
So there's only one published list so far with In Search for Greatness in either Modern or Pioneer, and it is a Modern Devotion list that is the same skeleton. This was from the very first weekend that Kaldheim was legal. I think it took 32nd place or something in a challenge. It had a few cards different. It was playing Llanowar Visionary, the cantrip.
Oh, I love that card, so that's probably worth it.
Instead of the Devoted Druids, but there you lose kind of the Karn searching Umbral Mantle option. And it has some of the tricks that we've come to expect. You know, in Modern, you can not only get Nykthos Shrine to Nyx, but you can also fetch land for a Dryad Arbor, which will then produce extra with your Leyline of Abundance. So little things like that. This is, again, like David's saying, a shell that we know some things about, but it does need a little help, at least in Modern, to get over the top.
Yeah. One thing about these mono green walkers lists, though, is that whenever you play against them, you know, there's the matches where they just top deck three Nissas in a row or whatever, and they feel unstoppable. And there's the matches where they draw, you know, one planeswalker all game and they feel terrible. And so Search of Greatness actually provides a lot of value from the scries alone in those situations.
Yeah. Again, the times when you have bifurcated cards, if every card is worth the same, scrying is basically valueless. If mana creatures are important early, or hitting your lands is important early, and then once you do that, all you do is you want to hit your Karns or your Nissas, then scry is actually very valuable. Every time it's bottoming a card that isn't those cards is functionally like drawing a card. So yeah, once again, trying to take advantage of a deck where certain cards are important at certain times and other cards are important later, like Damon's saying.
And I noticed that your curve stops on 5 with Nissa Who Shakes the World and Elder Gargaroth. The Pioneer builds are going as high as 6 now because of Vorinclex. That seems to have overtaken Karn even as the big finisher of choice. Would you consider that in Modern as well?
No. I've been a big hater on Karn and Pioneer. I said 2 weeks ago that Vorinclex was going to replace Karn. Everybody listened to me, which was correct. Even though people are like, well, why are they abandoning Karn? Karn sucks in Pioneer. There's nothing to get. You actually can get cards that beat entire strategies, especially game one with Karn. And Karn does all the things that you were outlining, Dan, as tips and tricks. It is a tutor effect. It is a card that draws a bunch of stuff. So it lets you do stuff with all the extra mana if you're flashing stuff in Search for Greatness. So Karn works incredibly great with Search for Greatness and even has the ability to find an infinite combo piece with Umbral Mantle if you got a bunch of Leyline of Abundances down or even if you chose not to play Devoted Druid.
Yeah, fair point. Context is everything. Okay, so that's mono green.
All right, and then we have a little Bant list. This does have one Toski, so you can replace that with whatever, Tireless Tracker. But this list is trying to take advantage of the fact that we can flash in our two drops. So we have 2 Omen of the Sea, 3 Elidamri's Call, and 4 Icevan Quaddle. All those cards interact positively with In Search for Greatness. We also have 4 Stoneforge Mystic, which can tutor up, you know, a sword or our 1/5 is Batterskull. We also have a flash 4 drop in Restoration Angel and Venser Savant. So a lot of times, you know, what happens is you play Stoneforge and they kill it, strandering your Batterskull. You can flash in Restoration Angel or Venser Shaper Savant to trigger, you know, with a trigger on the stack to get your free Batterskull. And then it's kind of built like a standard deck. You've got, you know, some value 3 drops that you can play hopefully off of your In Search for Greatness trigger. So that's your 3 Teferi, 3 Skyclave Apparition, 1 Spellqueller to tutor for, 1 Eternal Witness. That's kind of just a value card. That could be a lot of different stuff. It could be Flicker Wisp, I thought about, if we're going to play Omen of the Sea. And then, yeah, Toski is just there as a tutor target. If you already have a bunch of creatures in play, you know, a bunch of 2s and 3s, if In Search for Greatness is triggering with a Teferi in play, it might be worth it to have a 4 to tutor up to start drawing cards.
So what I like about this list is that it's mostly good cards. I'm curious.
And then 4 In Search for Greatness.
Exactly. I'm curious if this is what you had in mind, Damon, when you're saying a deck wouldn't necessarily need to play 4 of this card.
Yeah, I think this is a list where you could probably just play, you know, 1 or 2 of these. And then this gives you room for more of the cards that Aspiring Spike plays, like the Force of Negations or whatever. And just have it be this kind of steady presence to help streamline things.
I wish there were a way to get rid of an extra In Search for Greatness. Like, it doesn't pitch to force, and it's just kind of sits around. I guess they do double scry.
Yeah. Yep.
Or scry away from other In Search of Greatnesses, at least.
My other question is, do you think that this would outperform another vial? So here, I mean, I guess the answer is probably yes, because this is a mix of different permanent types. You can drop in a Teferi off this. You can drop in artifacts off this. Drop in Omen of the Sea. But on the other hand, Aether Vial is just a much friendlier play pattern in Modern. You know, it's half the mana, comes out on turn one.
Yeah, it's tough. In this particular designed list, it's much better than Aether Vial. But you could argue that a better list would maybe play Aether Vial, although I don't think that the best version of these Bant lists play Aether Vial, but that's because they're playing Force of Negation, which we're not playing. So it's a long way of saying probably the best way to design a Bant creature list that isn't playing Ephemerate is to play Aether Vial instead of In Search for Greatness. Mm. But at the same time, you know, we're not going to find out unless we actually kind of go whole hog. So it's also cool that if you have In Search for Greatness on two and you just have lands in play, but you drew like a Utopia Sprawl on turn two, you can play it for free in your upkeep. So it's like a functional, like if you drew quote unquote Utopia Sprawl like one turn too late.
Oh, yeah.
You kind of actually, you get that mana back.
Yeah, that is nice. I do like how, you know, it will always start on one, right? So you can drop in your Oath of Nyssa on turn three upkeep, and it's more or less the same as dropping it in on turn one. Utopia Sprawl the same way.
Yeah.
So we have a slate of options before us. Where do you think you guys want to start?
I'm excited for Pioneer Enigmatic Incarnation. Let's just play out in a very fun, enjoyable way. It's different from how most decks work.
It's also nice too because it's so customizable. Like, I don't like whatever Reflector Mage. Pretty easy to turn that into the one white blue wizard Vildalkin, whatever, and you know, it's kind of the same card. Worth noting, by the way, the one white blue 1/3, what's it called, Dan? You always know the names of these cards.
Deputy Detention, is that the one?
Yeah, Deputy Detention. The card has interesting synergy against Tybalt. So when you exile Tybalt, if they eventually kill it, it comes back as Valky. So these lists with Bring to Light don't have another way to turn that Valky into anything else. So it functionally gets rid of it forever.
Oh, you mean as a tutor target to fetch up your deputy against opposing Tybalts?
Yes. So maybe Reflector Mage should be that just as well while we're talking about it.
Example of generals fighting the last war.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I love the Modern lists because they're full of good cards. And I think that's a nice test just for the baseline power of In Search for Greatness is to see how it functions when surrounded by a mostly functional team. That being said, I'm probably going to start with that Nico Eris concept and try to go Enchantress and Pioneer.
Yeah, the one thing that I think is like a legitimate flag is that In Search for Greatness at green-green is a real cost. When you're playing Icefang Quaddle, you do want to play a lot of Snowlands so that it actually, you know, is a blocker. A lot of times it dies, but if it doesn't, you want it to be able to block Death Shadow or whatever. Well, there's only so many Snowlands you get to fetch out if you're trying to play green-green and you need blue to, you know, cast your Quaddle and you need white-white for Skyclave Apparition. I have four on thin ice here, but I think maybe that should be path just because I don't think you can ever really fetch basic planes early in the game, basic snow planes. So that's a real consideration in the Bant list. So the mana is not trivial.
If you look at the like kind of four color Omnath Blade decks that I think are actually also doing quite well in addition to the Bant ones, they play a surprising number of snow covered forests because they play so many Noble Hierarchs and things like that they want to play on one. So I think that those lists wouldn't actually have that much trouble playing In Search of Greatness on turn two. You'd probably want to consider cutting Renin or at least trimming Renin sixes just because the two drop otherwise gets a little bit jammed up. But that might also be a direction worth trying where, you know, just like I like to tweak Blue Moon by changing one card for the new card, take the Omnath Blade list and just cut a Renin 6 for an In Search of Greatness and see how it does and tune from there.
And don't forget the fetchable snow duels that come into play tapped. We've seen multicolor snow decks in Modern that play usually two of the fetchable tapped snow duels. All right, well, we have our homework cut out for us with In Search of Greatness. We will, of course, let you know next week how our testing turns out. With that said, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we will tell you all about our results with Righteous Valkyrie.
So our card last week was Righteous Valkyrie. Just a quick reminder, Righteous Valkyrie, 2 and a white for a 2/4 angel cleric with flying. Whenever another angel or cleric enters the battlefield under your control, you gain life equal to that creature's toughness. as long as you have at least 7 life more than your starting life total, so 27 for those of us who are playing normal Magic, creatures you control get +2/+2, including Righteous Valkyrie. So we had a bunch of different shells we want to try out. Dan, you started with sort of a, you called it a Righteous Sisters build in Modern. So why don't you tell us about that?
Yes, Righteous Sisters. So it's taking the Soul Sisters concept, that means Soul Warden, that means Soul's Attendant, and Oriok Champion, 8 total of those, even a Johnny's Primate to grow a little bit whenever you're triggering creatures coming in, gaining life. Typically, these decks have had Sera Ascendant as your big payoff, and then Speaker of the Heavens as another payoff. This list is playing a full boat of each of those, and 4 Martyr of Sands to get a big boost to your life total. The top of the curve is 4 Righteous Valkyrie, 3 Ranger Captain of Eos, 4 Heliod Sun Crown, and 3 Walking Ballistas, paired with 22 lands. The card that's missing is Squadron Hawk, so this is just a straight up draw Martyr and hope that you can activate it for 6 life, maybe 9 if you're lucky. But even that is enough, because they were kind enough to give Speaker of the Heavens Vigilance. That means that you can play Speaker on 1, attack for 1, go up to 21, play your Martyr, gain 6, go up to 27. And in my leagues, this came up all the time. I play my Speaker, they play an Elf, and I just, you know, look directly into their eyes and attack and wait and see if they block and trade or not. They should have traded. So how did this turn out? Well, it turned out pretty well. I went 4-1. The first round was against Green-White Heliod, and that did not go well, and I was pretty discouraged. But once I got paired against some more favorable matchups, I played against Elves, I played against Burn, Obosh Red, and Ponza. So green and red decks where gaining life matters, creature size matters, and even the flying from Righteous Valkyrie ended up mattering quite a bit. I was actually pretty impressed by what the Valkyrie can do. This list was pretty frequently getting up there. It wasn't super hard to get up to 27. Sometimes it was. Like against the Elves player, there was a game that I lost where I was like 2 life away from getting to 27 and they hit Shaman of the Pack. And then the next turn I got back to like 26 and they had another Shaman of the Pack. And I just like never got to activate my Speaker of the Heavens. But on the whole, the power is actually surprisingly okay-ish, just mainly on the back of the Valkyries.
Damon, you played a similar list to this. I don't know exactly which cards were different, but do you want to talk about your experience? I think you were a little less high on the card.
Yeah, so my list didn't have the Heliod combo or the Walking Ballistas, and instead I was playing... what was I even playing instead?
Squadron Hawk,
yeah, like. Squadron Hawks and things like that. Much more of like a Martyr proc type build, without the, I guess, the proc half. And yeah, I think I hit worse matchups. I hit, you know, Bant Midrange, and they just... Game 1, they played Tireless Tracker into Spellqueller, and I couldn't find a Skyclave Apparition or any removal. So I lost, although it was close. If I had had another white card to have my initial Martyr get me above 27, I think I actually would have won that game. Then I played against Blue-Black Urza. They did this thing where they, you know, maybe you've heard of it, they go infinite with Urza and Thopter Sword. That was not good. The deck is pretty cold. There's not many outs from Snaring Bridge. Then I played against Red-Black Shadow, and in part because I didn't have a bunch of ticks ready to buy a bunch of Oriok Champions, which are now almost 50 ticks. My sideboard was a little bit watered down, but also they just go, you know, Bolt, Push, Dreadbore, and you look at your board, you're 22 life, and you have a bunch of stuff in hand, and, you know, their Scourge is turned off, but their Death Shadows aren't. So I went up pretty quickly 0-6 in games in the 0-3 bracket, where I pulled 2 off against Sultai Mill and Blue-Red Annex Spreading Seas Land Control, where I won both those matchups. So at least I could fight it out in the 0-3 bracket, or as Dan says, there is no 0-3 bracket, there's just 2 threes. This deck is weird in the sense that it's missing something to do if you're at 18 life. Like, your Ranger Captain of Eos finds you a bunch of useless 1-drops if your hand isn't large enough to make use of fetching a Martyr. And so... it's just like once your life total goes down, it's hard to get it back up sometimes. And so things kind of need to go right from the beginning. And if they don't, they spiral way out of control. I also just didn't hit a bunch of like red matchups. Red-Black Shadow kind of counts, but kind of doesn't because those Death Shadows get super big.
Yeah, I think that your build is trying to find its power from more traditionally good cards like Stoneforge Mystic and Equipment. And then you have a lot of interaction, full boat of Skyclave Apparitions. But how much of your deck is actually dedicated to life gain? It's basically just the Martyr of Sands and the cards that tutor for them. The Valkyries will gain life off of each other, but they don't have like Bishop of Wings. They don't have other angels to trigger off of. So it's kind of like, do you draw a Martyr or not? That's your way up to the coveted threshold of 27 life. Whereas the Soul Sisters build had a bunch of cards that are just there to gain life. You know, the 8 Soul Warden effects. it works because you're getting paid off of Heliod for that too. And then you have like the backdoor Heliod Ballista combo. I found that like the weakest parts of the deck were like the Sarah Ascendance and to a lesser extent, the Speaker of the Heavens. But, you know, the Speaker's actually pretty good with Valkyrie. Sarah Ascendant, not so much.
Yeah. The thing with Wretched's Valkyrie too is that it's pretty weak to removal, where if you're relying on its buff to make an attack profitable, you know, that buff could be short-lived.
Well, what was it dying to? I mean, I found that it's actually pretty resilient.
Push, Path, Abrupt Decay, Assassin's Trophy. There's a lot of spells in Modern that kill it.
Oh, okay. So you're talking about theoretically. You're not talking about things you actually faced.
Oh, I definitely got Paths in one of my matches. I think it got pushed in another matchup. It got pushed in another matchup.
Yeah, I mean, Damon...
It got Assassin's Trophy in another matchup. No, I think there are at least four matchups where it died. Against Blue-Red Land Control, it was pretty good. They had bolts.
Damon likes to tell his tale of woe, but if you look at his screenshots, he's like a turn away from winning a lot of these games. And, you know, like the opponent top-decked TBR when you had a wide board of Squadron Hawks and that kind of thing and a Batter Skull. Or the worst that combo happens at the last minute. I mean, these things happen. This deck is maybe like a turn to three quarters of a turn too slow to like outrace other decks. But if it is a matter of just like gaining life and winning combat, I think that Righteous Valkyrie has the right skills, although maybe it's better in the Soul Sisters configuration.
Yeah, I agree. I think that Dan's build was probably the better build overall. I think Dan's build will also have a little bit better game against control decks because of the possibility of Heliod combo. I didn't face any kind of true Soul Sisters predators, like for example, that blue-white control list would not be a fun matchup. But the deck, the games were a little bit closer. But again, the way things fell out of control, it makes you feel kind of bad.
Yeah, I mean, playing a white deck, so you never feel good when things go wrong. You know, there's no coming back from any of this.
Yeah, and also you'll just draw, you know, eight planesome games by turn eight, because white decks have no ability to control the top of their deck.
So before we leave Modern, I tried one other build. This was a Bant Collected Company build, and both of the builds I played were based on the concepts that David had outlined. So the concept here, as I understood it, was that you want to give Bishop of Wings a chance to prove itself in Modern. So you have Righteous Valkyrie, Resplendent Angel, Bishop of Wings. This is kind of your angel package and collect a company to find them all. Unsettled Mariner comes in on a blue splash to give you another thing that counts as an angel. So now you have actually 12 angels you can hit off the collected companies. And Geist of St. Traft, this was, I think, the really cool find that you came up with, David, because it counts as a cleric when it enters the battlefield, and then when it attacks, will create an angel token. Rounding out the list, four collected company, eight mana dorks, Archangel of Thune, and a couple charming prints. So I took this into a league and I went 3-2. It has some spectacular lines. So I have a screenshot here from a game against Amulet Titan where I won the die roll, played a Noble Hierarch into a Geist of St. Traft. Pretty cool, right? But what's the worst that can happen? You know, I attack for seven with my Geist of St. Traft? No, the worst that can happen is that I play collected company on turn three, hit two Righteous Valkyries, that gains eight life right off the bat, attack with Geist of St. Traft, creates another angel, gains eight more life. Now both my Righteous Valkyries are turned on, so I'm attacking with a seven power Traft and an eight power angel token. I have like 30 some power in play, and I have like 30 some life. It was just like spectacular turn. I dealt 15 damage and just had this massive board state off of three cards. Well, four cards, but the company got me two of them. So the power was definitely there. The matchups that I lost were, I lost to a Rakdos Shadow deck where I thought I had the tools, you know, I had my Oryog Champions full playset on the sideboard, and I lost to Ponza where I knew they were going to Blood Moon me and I just like couldn't fetch around it because the mana requirements were a little bit too stringent, just with white and green, and then also needed to find blue. It was like a little bit tough. So that left me a little bit irked, I would say, just like, man, I thought I was prepped for these. I knew how it was going to go down. I knew what I had to do, and I just like couldn't do it. As a post-mortem looking at the list, part of the issue was that there's not a ton of card advantage in here. If you're not drawing the company, if the company is not hitting good things, and if you're not making extra free tokens off the Resplendent Angels, you're actually not really going 2-for-1 very often.
So you preferred the mono-white build is what you're saying.
You know, I'm not sure. Like, the mono-white build was so weird. It had all these crappy 1-1s. Even though I went 4-1 with that one, it felt like a little bit of a softer deck. Whereas it seemed like maybe if I could just clean up the Bant build, and maybe as much as I love the Geist of St. Traft line, the blue splash complicated the mana a lot. And maybe reimagine that, I really enjoyed having the option to Speaker of Heavens with Righteous Valkyrie at the same in play at the same time. So maybe like rebuild it as straight green and white with Speaker of the Heavens.
Yeah. And Dan has a draft that he came up with Ilsic Nasty posted in the show notes, which is worth checking out. This is basically the version of Without Blue. And this looks like a good list to me. You get the Speaker of Heavens as a search. Well, I guess you don't play a Ranger Captain, but you could play a Ranger Captain or two in here.
Yeah, this curve is based on the curve of like Bant Spirits, where you have Vials, Hierarchs, and another one drop. That's a Speaker of Heavens. A bunch of three drops, Righteous Valkyrie, Resplendent Angel, Skyclave Apparition, even a couple Angel of Vitalities. And then on the two drops, you have Bishop of Wings, Oriok Champion, Main, a couple Sarah Avengers, which you can vial in, which is something that David was interested in last week. So this is something to explore. It's like a medium to medium plus power deck. You can get your wins with it. I feel like there's more to learn about it in Modern. That being said, though, let's shift over to Pioneer, where David, you took a Orzhov build into the leagues.
Yeah, I took an Orzhov build into the leagues. I played it through two of them, and I went 2-3-3-2. And yeah, I think we were just like a week too late on this. I think when Pioneer was new and everyone was playing these like mono green beatdown decks and mono red beatdown decks, this would have been an easy 4-1, and I would have probably 5-0'd one of these leagues. Now, though, I think the format has adjusted, and there are a lot of decks that have made adjustments to their main deck or their sideboard, and they still get to play their sort of little kid Urien lists. They're just chock full of a ton of removal. And that removal is not just good against, Goblin Guide-like effects. It's good against our stuff. I mean, Righteous Valkyrie just lines up poorly against Abrupt Decay, Fatal Push, Dreadbore, Roiling Vortex, Wrath of God, Heartless Act, Omnath, any combo list at all. So basically, I beat all the aggro decks, although I did split with Mono Red, which sucked. They just drew... three Roiling Vortexes, and I drew two Skyclave Apparitions. And when I Charming Princed the second one to kill the Roiling Vortex, they had the burn spell for it. And so they had one spell to top deck, a card to kill me, and of course they did. So you don't even dominate the Mono Red matchup, is what I'm saying. I think the list is just a little too medium, this list is. You can't compete with any of the mid-range shells, and beating the aggro decks is just something anyone can do if they want. So,
in terms of construction, did you find that having 8 angels was enough? Or sorry, you have 10 angels with 2 Archangel of Thunes. Was 10 angels enough?
Yeah. I'm also playing a ton of clerics, and any angel that dies was rebought by my Sorin. Yeah, the life gain was never a problem. The problem was even with the life gain, and I turned them on turn 4, either trigger Resplendent Angel or Righteous Valkyrie, basically, by turn 4. That just isn't fast enough. They play, Binding the Old Gods or Wrath of God effect, and or they start their combo on their turn 5 because you've only done, 12 damage to them. That's it. I mean, you don't have a lot of ways to interact. It's hard to kill all the permanents that the various ultimatums put into play. Yeah, you just can't really fight. You can win one of three games against Niv, but they're likely to beat you. And it's funny, Omnath gains 4 life on your turn and their turn. And I think with the requirement to play Bishop of Wings, which is white and Pioneer, your mana is actually probably more restricted than theirs. So yeah, it's a tough ask for a deck that's playing, a 3-mana 2/4 that doesn't do anything the turn it comes into play.
Sounds like we should be playing Righteous Valkyrie with 4-color Omnath.
Yeah, the only reason they don't have to do that is because they can just win the game instead of playing a 3-mana 4/6 card.
That is one of the best ways to gain a bunch of life.
Yeah, Omnath is actually just better at it than the card that's specifically designed for it. It's really sad. And Uro would be an even better way to gain life if that was still legal. It's probably gains on... I did have a few games where I was just gaining I won against black-white Orzhov Bogles with 150 life, which was awesome. I finally drew the Resplendent Angel to just crap out an Angel of Turn while I was doing that. They were attacking me and I was just chump blocking with Thraven Inspectors that I kept buying back. And then I was hitting them with multiple Righteous Avengers in the air. So they were basically staying even at 12 every turn. They were doing 15 and taking 15. but I was just gaining an insane amount of life every turn until eventually they gave up the ghost.
So after hearing about your results, I wondered if part of the reason the deck struggled against these bigger control decks was that it didn't have any explosive lines. And the explosive line that I wanted was Speaker of the Heavens on turn one into like Heroes Reunion on turn two. This is something that Will Urker had been having some success with a few weeks back. I want to just like experience it for myself, live that dream. So I took a look at his build and I changed a couple of cards. You know, I swapped All State of Life's Bounty in for Self of Savior because I wanted more lifelinkers. And I tried out Resplendent Marshal. This is another 3-mana angel from Kaldheim. But basically you're looking at a green-white company deck that has outs to just like have a Speaker on one, a Heroes Reunion on two, starting up the Angel Chain right away. You also have your Bishop of Wings, etc. Luminarch Aspirant is also here to make your lifelinkers a little more threatening and just give you something to do in the early turns. So this is what I tried, and boy, it was not good. Everything that David said about the metagame, I discovered for myself. I got obliterated by three control decks the first three rounds. I finally found a red deck in the 0-3 bracket and was able to close it out with a wins against red and John Citadel. But yeah, like push, sweeper, Bantu's Last Reckoning, and dig through time. It's like, this is, you know, sending a green-white mid-range deck into that metagame is just like a lamb to the slaughter. This is a disastrous metagame for this style of deck. So I will post a suggested update to the list, which you can play at your own peril, but basically it's just kind of like abandoning the cheap Heroes Reunion, get lucky wins, and trying to grind a little bit more to account for the realities of the Pioneer metagame. So like Maze Mind Tome to gain life and Pulse of Marasa to gain life instead of just straight up 2-mana gain 7.
Yeah, I mean, one of the major problems is that Valkyrie also requires you to play other creatures to trigger it or to get buffed by its bonus. So it is especially weak to Wrath effects. Like, you play it on turn two, you have to play your crappy 1/4 Bishop, which is not a good card. Okay, you play, you gain 4 life. You have to play another Angel to trigger it. So, like, you're just playing into Wrath. You just have to. And so every time they cast a Wrath, it's just a 3-for-1. That's a yeah. lock. That's the lock of the millennium. So, yeah, if they just have a bunch of 4-mana, 3-for-1s that they also probably went up, like, 4-mana on you, I mean, that one play just wins the game. The game is over at that point. You can keep playing if you want to watch some Resolve, Dig Through Time, or some Dragon, or Nibbizzit, or whatever else they have. Valky, if you want to see Tybalt again, that's fine. But yeah, I mean, you just can't play these mid-range lists like this anymore without either black or blue interaction. I think the success some people were having at the beginning was an artifact of a different metagame, like I said. Had we played this 10 days earlier, I think Dan and I would have both 4-1, and we'd be talking about how sweet this card is.
Yeah, it just feels like this card is missing, you know, if you're above 27 life, your creatures get indestructible or something, so that the control decks, once you reach that point, you know, it's not your fault they're not playing creatures to press your life total. But yeah, instead you have to go wide to make Valkyrie, you know, the payoff good. And meanwhile, you also have to, like, gain a bunch of life, which is a very narrow thing to do. And a single Wrath just ruins your whole day.
And we know, I mean, from experience, life gain decks just are going to have really bifurcated matchups. They're always going to struggle against control. They always kind of have. And they're, you know, very good against decks that are trying to whittle your, you know, trying to trade cards for your life. So I think we found that to be true. When we run into good matchups, the deck feels good. It's allowed to do what it does. When our 4-butt toughness creature runs into removal that isn't good against it, then it's much better than when, you know, they're gaining a mana or 2-mana every exchange.
Righteous Valkyrie is also let down a little bit by the angel options. I did think that the Resplendent Angel, Bishop of Wings, Valkyrie trio was like really sweet and strong. But beyond that, you're really scraping the bottom of the barrel. There's not many choices to begin with, but like Resplendent Marshal is like, okay. Unsettled Mariner is like, eh. Lin Vala, the Shield of Seagate or whatever, the new one from Zendikar, that would maybe be okay if you were going to play blue. That can save you from a Wrath. But I mean, what else is there beyond that? There's the Youthful Valkyrie, there's Sarah Avenger in Modern. There's just like not much. So it felt like there's like holes in the curve, especially at 1 and 2 mana, where there aren't really cards that you're excited to put into this show. If that can be solved, maybe in a set or three, I think the power is there from the Righteous Valkyrie. That was my takeaway, at least. I was like pretty happy with what it does when it's turned on.
I mean, the only card that I felt like lined up well with other like value cards was Archangel of Thune, because yes, it dies for removal sometimes inefficiently, but if it was allowed to stick around for 2 turns, I was like beating red-black Arcanists. I mean, they basically played their whole deck and had a huge board, and it like Archangel of Thune almost did it all by itself. That's the only card that felt like it was at that power level. The problem was eventually they found their stupid like 1-black sacrifice a creature, destroy any creature that actually killed my beautiful Archangel of Thune, and then my plans came crumbling down. But yeah, Archangel of Thune, like, coming down, immediately triggering Valkyrie or the Bishop, and then, like, just adding, like, 6 power, 7 power, and then threatening to, like, take over was something. But 5 mana is just so much, and 5 mana is drawing your opponent, you know, a Tybalt or a Niv-Mizzet or a Binding of the Old Gods. Once they've completed that, like, 3-for-1 or 4-for-1, then there's nothing to be done.
So what are our final takeaways for Righteous Valkyrie after a week of trying it out?
I think in the right metagame, the card is super powerful. I don't think the metagame that is amenable to that is what exists in Pioneer right now. But when it, or if it goes back to aggro, then this is the kind of deck that would be awesome. You have an awesome matchup without trying. And if you don't have to play other mid-range decks, but other like combo decks, then you can fix that in board. But having to deal with like actual value type of matchups is probably going to be unfixable.
Yeah, Righteous Valkyrie just demands a lot of how you build your deck, and then it's vulnerable to a lot of commonly played removal spells. And so even though it has the ability to set up some sweet early, you know, insane turns, like Dan mentioned, to me, the card just has some structural weaknesses that we'll need to have my 27 life or more, your creatures get an indestructible card released to take this card to the next level.
Yeah, and much like we've seen with Magda, if you're identifying a creature and assuming that the creature has to be in play for your deck to do anything, that's just not going to work out, right? But if it's a supporting player in a deck that is otherwise like mostly functional, you're going to just be happier, I think, with your overall results. So I think that's the question. I mean, can you build a Righteous Valkyrie deck that makes it powerful without having to like resort to C-tier angels and Bishop of Wings? And that's the question. I mean, the answer to that might shift over time. But until it does, we'll leave it here. As always, if you have some sweet lists with Righteous Valkyrie, you can send them to us. We are at FaithlessMTG on Twitter. We would love to see what you're working on.
Yeah, and until next week, we will be going off in search of greatness. And so stick around and come back and see if we found it.
Take care.
All right, take care, gentlemen.
That's a wrap on episode 13 of Kaldheim Season. Tune in next week for our testing results with In Search of Greatness, and download the latest deck list at faithlessbrewing.com. If you would like to support the show, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/faithlessbrewing. A pledge at any tier gets access to our Discord channel and an amazing community of brewers like you. That's all for today. Stay safe out there, and we'll see you next time.